So you've done a lot of work all over the world. Can you tell us about the work that you did photographing in Kazakhstan, capturing the consequences of the Soviet nuclear weapons testing?
So I went to Kazakhstan because I was taking a class actually in university, and I read about the after effects of nuclear testing in the Soviet Union. And it occurred to me that I knew very little about what happened. And so I think I went to Kazakhstan to try to understand what were the effects of the Cold War on a civilian population that a lot of people in the West don't really know anything about. Before I went there, to me, Kazakhstan was a place that I knew academically, and I knew geopolitically where it fit into the Cold War. But I think from a societal point of view, like, I don't think very many people in Canada or in the West know so much about it. So when I went to this town called Semipalatinsk, or now it's called Semei, and I started meeting these people who were exposed to radiation, or their parents were exposed to radiation, or their grandparents were. And even to this day, there is a generation of people who are born with the effects of radiation poisoning based off of Soviet nuclear weapons testing. Over 400 nuclear weapons were detonated in the Kazakh steppe, and millions of people were exposed to radiation. And so I was just shocked at the fact that I knew nothing about it. So one by one, I started meeting people who were affected by the radiation, and a lot of the times people would be born with deformities. People would have radiation-related illnesses. And so from that, I started to photograph the people affected and became quite close to different families and spent a lot of time with them. And from these pictures started to tell the wider story of what happened there during the Cold War. So when I was in Kazakhstan, I think I try to spend as much time as with people as possible, and often in, like, I try very intimate spaces where people can be vulnerable but also show their humanity. And so when I first met Myra, she has, at that time, a 16-year-old daughter who was born with microcephaly, and she was conscious but basically couldn't do anything for herself. Janur had to be by her mother's side 24/7. And so I met them in the morning, and, you know, I interviewed them and I learned about their day. And we would keep going back there for days and days and days. And I thought to myself, well, like, how do I show that Janur never leaves her mother's side, and a mother's love is such that she'll never leave her daughter's side? And so I asked, you know, is it okay to stay during the night and film you at night? And I know that's a lot to ask, because, you know, like, it's, how does a journalist come in and ask to basically, like, photograph them in bed sleeping? But that's what I asked, and I built up that trust over multiple visits, and I told them, like, look, I want to show your emotion and how much you love your daughter and just that attachment. And so I stayed there for quite some time and just, like, waited until they drifted off to sleep. And I kind of got on the bed and photographed them from above. And that's something that you can't just walk into. You need to build up to that. And the reason why, when I even, like, asked that, they said, well, why is that? Like, why would you want to photograph that? And I told them, like, look, I need to show this love and intimacy so someone, regardless of their culture, their language, no matter where they are, can relate to this image. And, you know, I showed them that photo, and the mother started crying, and she said, that's every day for me. And if we can try to capture that semblance of intimate truth, I think that's why we do what we do.
I've seen a lot of those photos, actually, and they're pretty moving. Was it hard emotionally to be, like, learning about these people that, like, you didn't know about, like, how this had really impacted them?
It was difficult gaining people's trust at first. I think clearly when you're meeting people who are born handicapped or they're visually deformed, like it, there is a immediate reaction that a photographer is coming in to exploit, you know, their tragedy and to exploit the way they look. And so going in, that was what I had to explain to people is if people don't know what happened, then how can any meaningful policy change come out of it? And how do we make sure that something like this doesn't happen again? And so I think that's the baseline going in is you have to get people to trust what your intentions are. And that, I think, at first, if people are hesitant to speak to you, you know, I think that's completely fair because you're a foreigner coming in and you're asking to be a witness to very intimate moments, very private moments in people's homes. And that's a lot to ask. And I think you have to be sensitive to how people would feel being photographed. And I think what it takes is time, and it takes building a connection before you even start to take a photo. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the times in the stories I do, I will just go without a camera or go with a camera in my bag. And you connect with people as from human being to human being first. And only when I personally feel like I've been able to build up a sense of rapport and trust and they understand what my intentions are and what I'm trying to do, do I maybe take out the camera and start to photograph. Every story is different, but I think in the story I did in Kazakhstan, it's a very specific context because it's not like there's anything immediate happening. And one question that people would ask me is like, you know, journalists come and go and nothing changes. How are you so different? And that's a question that I really struggled with when I first got there. And it's a question that I still ask myself to this day. Was it worth doing the story? Did I help at all? Did it lead to anything meaningful? And there are a few cases where the photos I published led to people internationally, you know, donating money to some of these families. There were cases where research companies would see someone who was disabled who couldn't move. And then they would, one person was offered like an experimental device to help them like type, you know, and that's because they saw our photos. So it's hard to say if like my photos did anything super groundbreaking, but you know, like I can at least feel to myself that like for the few individuals I photographed, like maybe something good came out of that experience and their story being shared with the world. And you know, that's really all that you can really ask for sometimes.
Yeah. So when you go out to a story, what are you trying to capture with your photographs?
I think when I go out into the field, wherever it is, and regardless of what kind of situation it is, whether it's breaking news or a feature story or a long-term documentary, I think the first thing that you try to do is just connect with people. That's first and foremost the most important thing, because like if you can't connect with them, or if you can't empathize, or you can't see why you're there, then maybe you don't deserve to take a picture of them. You know, like you don't deserve to tell their story. So I think first off, you have to recognize that you are a foreigner coming into a space, and oftentimes you're coming in from a very privileged point of view. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. It just is. And so the first thing you have to do is like check your point of reference as to why are you the person to tell this story? Is there someone locally who could do it better than you? Or how can you work with someone to tell an accurate story? So that's first off. And then second is you just have to build relationships with either the community you're in or individuals that you're with. And again, make your intentions clear. Like, it's okay to not know things. It's okay to ask questions. In fact, you should ask questions. And a lot of times, like, it's a really delicate balance of you have to do your research to know the context of what story you're going into. But then you also have to then recognize that all the research that you've done, previous articles, and the history, you know, was written by people, and they could be wrong. They could have their own biases. It might be dated. It might be written in a different time, in a different social context. And so you have to, you can get to a point where maybe you do too much research, and then if you go in there with preconceived notions, you're then kind of like furthering a narrative that has already been written, and maybe that's the wrong narrative. But you also have to know your history and know what the context is. So it's a really fine balance between it's a really fine balance between being informed so you know what questions to ask and also having an open mind so that you're not going into a story with preconceived ideas. And I think that's what's really difficult working as a journalist, because when you go to a story, you more or less always have to pitch an editor to say, like, I want to go do this story because of X, Y, Z. This is what I hope to find, and this is the story I want to tell. But by mere fact of doing that, you've already written a story in your head which may or may not be true. And it's actually stressful when you go in. What if the story is completely different than what you envisioned? And then you have to tell your editor, like, sorry, the $2,000 plane ticket to get here and all this time isn't actually what I thought. And you have to be open to be able to adapt and find another story that's equally powerful. And just, you can't be so set in your ways that you have to be really open and flexible.
Yeah. Earlier you were talking about being wary of being exploitative. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if, A, you do ever feel that way. And is there like a list of ethical things you have running in the back of your mind when you go to photograph someone?
I think about exploitation and representation like every day. And I think about, why is it that I'm here to do this? And oftentimes, like, maybe I'm not the best person to do a story. I think, you know, working in the Middle East for the last decade or so, oftentimes, you know, as journalists, as foreign journalists, we are immune to so many of the things that local journalists face. You know, if there is backlash for any story, at best, I get deported. But if you're a local journalist in Turkey, for example, you can be imprisoned. So, for example, recently I was banned from Turkey. And it's a shame that I can't go back. But at the same time, like, I'm really lucky to have a Canadian passport that, you know, that's not my home. But if you're a Turkish journalist, like, you are in a completely different situation. I think a lot of times people don't think about the dangers that local journalists face. And the reason I bring this up is because there are things that sometimes only a foreigner can do because of, let's say, the dangers or having an outside context. And there's other stories that a local should do. And I think the best kind of journalism is when outsiders work in tandem with the people who have a stake in that community. Because oftentimes in conflict, it takes an outsider who has zero stake in both in any side to be able to seek out a more impartial version of truth. Whereas if you're living in a conflict and you are a part of, let's say, one sect, one culture, one religion, you know, you might be biased in a certain way. And so I think it really takes a consideration of how are we best representing truth by working with people there and by being an outsider. So when I think about all those things summed up, sometimes then I think to myself, like, I can offer an objective point of view for, let's say, a conflict or a story that I have nothing to do with. But that applies in some contexts, and other times, like, that doesn't apply because you're coming in as a Canadian or a Westerner, clearly more privileged, and, you know, like, you have your own preconceived notions of things. So I think it's just really important to keep all those things in check and always be questioning what you're doing, why you're doing it, and your motivations behind it. Yeah. And you'll never have the right answer, but I think it's important to ask the question.
In the panel that during the RRJ conference, you had talked about or noticed a generational divide between the people that were on the photography panel. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think the craft of journalism is an organic and evolving concept that also changes with the times that we're in. So a journalist who was alive in the 60s or the 40s or 2000s has, I think, they're beholden to whatever cultural construct or what's appropriate at that time. And so as that shifts, journalists also have to shift with it. And so I think what's interesting generationally is that now we're at a point where questions in Canada about, let's say, cultural appropriation are a really big discussion of why, like, who are we as journalists to go into other communities to cover certain things? Or what kind of stories are we telling, and are we the best people to tell these stories? And it's not to say that these conversations didn't exist a while, like, in past generations, but I think maybe a lot of that's amplified now. So I would say that's like one generational difference. I think the other kind of generational difference is technology and the way that people consume the news. So if you're a journalist in, let's say, the 60s, 70s, 80s, and you're going to a conflict zone or a natural disaster or somewhere in a foreign country, chances are most of the people that you're photographing will never see the story that you do. They'll never read your story. They'll never see your photographs because, you know, what if the New York Times doesn't get delivered to Somalia? And so I think there was a lot less accountability for the photographer or the journalist going in with their subjects because most of the, there was an understanding that subjects would probably never see these stories in the first place. And so I think with that, journalists in the past didn't have to be as accountable for their reporting or their actions. And that's not, I know that's a little unfair to say that, but it's true in the sense that you can go and do a story and then come back to New York or Toronto or London, and chances are you'll never interact with your subjects again. But I think in our generation of journalists, or like now people who are born and raised with social media, the internet, most of your subjects will probably, you're communicating them with them via Facebook, and therefore like they will see every picture that you take, every tweet you tweet in real time. And that's both a good thing and a bad thing, because you have to ask yourself, well, am I okay with this person seeing the way I'm representing them right now? And what would they say about that? And that could inform the way that you report. That could inform the kind of photo you take. And that's not to say that like you should always be taking photos with the subject in mind, because if you're, let's say, photographing conflict, you might not necessarily want to be so empathetic or sympathetic with the person you're photographing, because they could be belligerents in a conflict. They could be any number of things. And in fact, actually, I've noticed working in the Middle East and, let's say, Ukraine, where our reporting is scrutinized in real time, that can get us in actual a lot of trouble, because if you write a critical article or if you take a photo that contradicts a government narrative, you could be attacked for that, or kidnapped or abducted or, you know, imprisoned for that immediately. And so that's where it turns. That's where I think that's a bad thing. But then again, if you're, let's say, photographing a marginalized community or a tragedy or something where you need to be especially sensitive and empathetic, and they see that you're not in real time, then I think maybe that's a good thing, because then you're accountable to your actions and the way you represent things. And so I think that's something that, like, it's not to say that people in the past didn't have to deal with that, but I think now stories are, narratives are formed even before the story is written or the photographs are taken. And so in that climate, we're in a really interesting but also a really complicated time in journalism and representation.